Welcome to Ex Libris, the premier podcast where the latest scientific discoveries are discussed in the context of their apologetic significance to the Christian faith. This program is brought to you by the monthly partners of Reasons to Believe. For more information, please visit reasons.org/monthly partners.
Are scientists playing God or not? We have a study about using gene editing techniques in human embryos and removing diseases, and these are the claims that are being made. And I'm joined here today with Anjanette A.J. Roberts to get the lowdown on what's going on. A.J., I know you've had spent a lot of work sitting around dealing with this, and I know you've done a lot with the CRISPR-Cas9 technology in the past. So kind of just take a few minutes and lay out what's being done and what are the big issues at play here.
Right. So first of all, for people who aren't familiar with what CRISPR-Cas9 or CRISPR gene editing is it's basically a system that was discovered in bacterial cells that serve as part of a bacterial immune system. And what researchers found in 2012 was that this immune system had the ability to recognize specific sequences in either RNA or DNA and to target those sequences, and then with a protein called Cas9 in this case, the Cas9 protein sort of tagged along with the RNA sequence that was generated to recognize either RNA or DNA that was complementary to that sequence. And as it tagged along and it hit the target, it could cleave the DNA in both strands of the DNA. And by creating a nick in the DNA, all kinds of things can happen before the cellular repair mechanisms kick in to rejoin the nicked DNA. You can introduce homologous DNA, you can introduce foreign DNA, or you can do nothing and just let the cellular repair mechanisms take place and rejoin the gap. And so
this is something in bacterial genomes, this is just happening all the time.
That's right. Okay. And it's a way that bacteria that get infected with a phage, a virus that infects bacteria, they can actually, in the process of responding to that phage, some of the bacteria in the population will actually generate little fragments of the viral DNA or RNA and generate the complementary DNA strands and insert it into its own genome, into the own bacterial genome, in this region where the CRISPR-Cas9 sequences and proteins are encoded and function. And so it's a way that bacteria that come out of the viral infection unharmed have mounted a way to defend themselves against the virus DNA or RNA of the intruder. And what happens is, in that case, the bacteria have this little recognition system, and that recognition system gets translated or transcribed into RNA. That RNA couples with an enzyme that then targets the viral DNA or RNA and chews it up or cuts it up. And so different Cas proteins are involved in the bacterial immune system. One of them, Cas3, will basically just cut the DNA of the virus, the RNA of the virus, repeatedly, sort of just like with mayhem, and basically just leave smears of genetic decay, rubbish. But Cas9 is very specific as a protein endonuclease, which basically means it cuts DNA. It cuts it in both strands, and it cuts it in a single spot.
Okay.
And so researchers have realized, back in 2012, they published this, that you can target the Cas9 protein to any DNA or RNA sequence that you want. If you know that sequence, all you have to do is provide a complementary sequence in an RNA form called a single guide RNA that is not just the target sequence in complementary form, but is also another piece of RNA called a tracer RNA that helps that RNA attach to the Cas9 protein. And so the Cas9 protein hangs on to that RNA that's targeting it to the gene of your choice or the DNA sequence of your choice, and allowing the Cas9 to cut that sequence at a very specific site.
Okay, so it sounds like, just kind of in a big picture, that this is a remarkably elegant error-correcting mechanism, if you will, that in the bacteria, or where it's used in bacteria, it's actually allowing the bacteria to maintain and survive in spite of all of these mutations and harmful environments. So
right.
It seems like there's a great elegance to it.
There's a fantastic elegance to what it's doing in the bacteria, and there's a cleverness to what scientists are extrapolating the uses for the CRISPR-Cas9 system into gene editing or genome modification. And you're right, one application is correcting errors, but another one would be introducing genes. Maybe if you had a gene that was completely defunct and mm-hmm. it wasn't just a single mutation, but an entirely defunct gene, you could replace the entire gene.
So as I am kind of trying to read and understand this, what I gather is going on is that there is this CRISPR-Cas9, whatever it's called.
System.
That's the system that the Cas9 will go in, and that's cutting the DNA. And then the CRISPR part basically inserts DNA of a certain part in there,
yeah,
right
no,
or wrong?
No, wrong. Okay. And I'm glad you asked that because I don't want to be confusing, right? So the CRISPR part is the RNA that's helping target the protein to the right place
okay.
on the genome. Now, if you want to actually replace it with healthy DNA, you have to provide that in tandem.
Okay.
Right? So it's not just the CRISPR RNA, single guide RNA. It's not just the CRISPR plus the Cas9 endonuclease protein doing the cutting. But it's whatever DNA you provide in tandem to either introduce into the genome or to fix the genome.
Okay, so the CRISPR-Cas9 goes in and figures out, okay, here's where we want to cut. The CRISPR figures out where to cut. The Cas9 cuts.
That's right.
And then there's a tandem piece of whatever DNA, RNA that goes in and says, all right, this is what we want to insert there or whatever the editing would be.
Yeah, and now hearing you say my words back to me, tandem probably isn't the best word to use because tandem sometimes implies that they're linked. And
okay.
They're not linked. They're just supplied together.
They're supplied together. Okay,
yeah.
So this is...
It's a three-component system.
Three-component system. Okay, so you have to have all of those in there to actually do something more than just cut things apart then, effectively.
That's right.
Okay,
that's
all right. So
in this paper, what they're doing is they're trying to target a specific gene that's associated with basically heart disease in about 1 in 500 people. And that gene, it's not important what the name of the gene is, but that gene basically affects the myosin levels in the muscle cells of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And those cells help regulate sort of the contraction and the beating of the heart. And so in adulthood, many people, and actually young adults, it's the number one killer of sort of unexpected death in otherwise healthy adults.
Mm-hmm.
It's heart failure due to the dysfunction of this protein.
Well, and my understanding was, I was doing a little reading, it's like it actually causes a certain segment of the heart muscle to enlarge.
I think it actually has several effects.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
so I got to get the exact name of it there if I can find it. They gave a name for the heart disease.
They did. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, as I recall.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
You know, at least as the images I looked up, it showed that this rather enlarged heart segment. It suffice it to say that it, in certain instances, can cause problems, shut down, end up.
That's right.
Respiratory problems, all sorts of things.
That's right.
And I also got the impression it was kind of undetectable, or it can be undetectable. There's a lot of people that have it. You said 1 in 500, you
yes.
didn't say, so
yeah.
kind of like 0.2% of the people have it, but it's often often undiagnosed. But so they're going in to try and specifically address this because presumably they found a genetic signature of this disease.
That's right. And there's not really a very good solution to the disease, right? There's
mm-hmm.
There's not a way to treat it really at the non-genetic level. Many people might end up having pacemakers inserted multiple times throughout their life and try to help regulate the heartbeat. But,
okay.
So
this is something,
so
once
genetic,
you've got it, you've got it.
Yeah, and a genetic solution is something that would be really appealing, right? Really attractive. And so that's in part why they targeted this specific gene. And what they've done is, so other people have published gene editing reports of human embryos. Basically,
mm-hmm.
Previously it's been mostly Chinese researchers, but research is going on in this area in the UK in addition to other places in the world. But this is the first report from US researchers,
mm-hmm.
and it was a group at Oregon State Health Center led by Shukrat.
Metopolov.
Yeah, I can't really read his name well, and especially
Shukrat
Metulopov. There we go. Shukrat Metulopov at Oregon State Health Center.
Right.
And You know, what they've done is they've basically looked at what the Chinese researchers found, which was very disheartening because the work that they were doing was basically saying, look, we're going to target this specific gene in human embryos, and we're going to fix something that's broken in that gene. Mm-hmm. And when they tried to do it, what they found is they had a huge number of off-target hits. And so that's one of the major concerns.
So that means presumably it went in and it did what it was supposed to, but then it did a whole bunch of stuff in other places in the genome.
That's
correct?
Right. That's right. Because the guide RNA is only about 20 bases long. And okay. So it's not a very long sequence. And so you can imagine 20 specific bases mm-hmm. out of the 3.1 haploid 6.2 billion base pair diploid human genome.
Right.
That 20 nucleotide sequence might occur in more than one place, right? So,
okay.
So you can extend the length of the RNA to try and help increase specificity, but you don't want it to become huge, right? Mm-hmm. You want it to remain manageable. But so what they've done is that they basically said, look, these researchers had huge off-target hits. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, they targeted the human embryo at the level of what's called the zygote. And the zygote is basically a fertilized egg. It's when the sperm and the egg have already come in contact. Mm-hmm. The egg is basically a haploid maternal mm-hmm. genome. The sperm is providing a haploid paternal mm-hmm. genome.
Right.
And then those two, they start as pronuclei, but then they fuse into a single nucleus. And you have sort of this other external surface structure on the fertilized egg called a polar body, mm-hmm. and that's basically where the egg is ejected its other haploid copy mm-hmm. of its DNA that it was, because they're taking eggs that are arrested in something called meiosis metaphase II.
Okay.
And so that's the stage that the ovum is in when it's released. So mm-hmm. so normally when a woman is ovulating, the eggs that are released during ovulation are in this stage.
Okay.
And so this is the stage that they're starting with. And then
That they were starting with, or that the previous folks were?
That these guys are starting with.
That these guys are starting,
yeah.
Okay.
So they're starting with that oocyte. We'll call it an M2 oocyte. And so they start with the M2 oocyte and sperm, and then their three-component system, mm-hmm. right? Which is, in this case, it is a purified recombinant Cas9 protein.
Okay.
So they've basically generated the protein in the lab and purified it from the system that they use to generate it.
Right.
And then they've taken single guide RNA,
okay.
and they're providing that as an RNA, I believe. I actually can't remember. Mm-hmm. It might have been in plasmid form, but I think it was a single guide RNA purified. And then the single-stranded DNA template to try and repair the
okay.
mutation in the gene. Right. And so they've done one of two things. They've said, we're going to try and get away from the off-target hit problem,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to try and get away from another problem, which is called mosaicism.
Okay.
Mosaicism. And mosaicism is basically, if you start with a multicellular embryo,
mm-hmm.
and you're trying to repair a gene in the cells of the embryo, and you introduce it into a multicellular state where it's already a 4-cell mm-hmm. embryo or an 8-cell embryo, you're not going to hit all of the cells when you
right.
try and make the correction. And so what happens as the embryo continues to undergo cell division and grow as an embryo, that you end up with what's called mosaicism, where
mm-hmm.
some cells have the fix and some cells still have the problem.
So you have a mosaic of
you
different
have,
things.
That's right. You have a mosaic.
So there's two difficulties that arise doing this. One is that you don't know whether you're targeting the specific or where in the genome it's actually done stuff, whether the specific site or other sites. And then there's an additional problem of if there's multiple cells there when you're doing the procedure, multiple cells could end up affected differently. And so you have effectively different genomes in the same organism.
That's
correct?
Right. That's right. And even at the single, what looks like a single cell stage, you may already have DNA replication, which might end up giving more than one copy of the mutated gene in the about to replicate and divide zygote. Right?
Okay.
And so at the zygote level, what they found in the study is you still end up with mosaicism. So if you don't fix it basically before it gets to the zygote point, you don't fix all the cells
right, okay.
all the time.
Okay, so this is, again, I remember reading in here where they were doing this and implanting when you had the egg and implanting the sperm into
you
it.
You don't want to use the word implanting when we talk about this because it makes it sound like you're putting it in back inside.
No,
the
you're
woman.
Right. Does okay. So maybe injecting into the egg, the CRISPR-Cas9 system and the guide cell as the sperm all at the same time. They're trying to get around this mosaic problem.
Well, no, actually, that's the second system that they
that's
set
the
up.
That's the second system.
Yeah,
that they
and
set
so
up.
Trying to get away from where the sperm has already fertilized the egg and they've already taken the zygote, which is at the pro where it has the two pro nuclei and the second polar body. So that's the zygote. That's a fertilized egg, right? They were manipulating that, and at that level, they found they still got mosaicism.
Okay.
Right? And so then they said, well, in parallel, they set it up so that they had only the ovum, the M2 oocyte, right? And they took the M2 oocyte, and they injected the sperm and the three-component system simultaneously.
Okay.
So they basically premix the sperm with the Cas9 protein, with the single-guide RNA, and the single-stranded DNA fixed template. And they inject that together into the cytoplasm of the M2 oocyte.
Right.
And at that point, they don't get mosaicism. They basically have solved that problem. But what they do get is, okay, so I need to back up a second and describe a little bit about the system in this respect, that the gene that causes the disease in the man who's donating the sperm is a heterozygote allele. And so it basically means that the man has a non-mutant allele and a healthy allele, right?
Okay.
So one allele, one set of his chromosome, he's a diploid individual, so his haploid copy of the chromosome that encodes this mutation has the mutation. The other copy of that same chromosome, and I think it was chromosome 20, doesn't have the mutation. And so when you take sperm from this individual man, it's got a 50% chance, basically, of having the mutation or not having the mutation, right? So they basically have set up a control where they take sperm from the man and they inject it into the egg. And 50% of the time, it's going to end up being a healthy egg.
Simply because it used the healthy segment.
That's right. Simply because it used the healthy sperm cell, right? So, but in the other 50% of the time, it's going to end up having the mutant sperm cell. And so what they find and what they report is that in this CRISPR-Cas9 intervention, that you have 72% of the embryos demonstrating a fix, right? That they basically have been fixed by this intervention at the M2 oocyte phase where they inject the... But it's really only a 22% effect, right? Because you're already going to get 50%.
That's exactly
what they find, right?
So they went from 50% healthy embryos to 75% or 72%, whatever it is. So in essence, this is kind of like half effective for the problematic cells.
That's right.
Okay.
And so you realize that 72% minus... from 100 leaves 28%. And so that's basically the failure rate, right? So you could consider that either maybe something went wrong with the delivery process, but when they went in and looked, they actually found some non-homologous end-joining recombination events, which basically suggests that CRISPR did something. It inserted something somewhere, but not what you wanted and not the way you want it, right?
Okay.
And not necessarily where you want it, right? Because they did find some off-target effects.
Right.
But then when they went and looked at the healthy embryos, right, the ones that they fixed, basically, they couldn't distinguish between ones that had been fixed by the provision of the DNA that they put into the system, the template that was supposed to fix it, right, be the template that didn't have the mutation, versus wild type. And what they were...
Wild type meaning
sort of the healthy maternal allele that was already there, right? So they couldn't distinguish, oh, these 50% came from the maternal fix and this 22% came from our intervention. Even though they tried to put a DNA template into the system that had a marker in it, so they'd be able to say, oh, look, there's our marker. Ours worked 22% of the time, right? What they found was that all 72% of the fix looked the same.
Right.
It all looked like the maternal allele. And so what they're basically concluding there is something that's actually really fascinating about this report, that maybe if you have a healthy copy of the allele already in the egg or whatever it is that you're trying to manipulate, you don't have to provide a healthy copy in conjunction with the system that you're, the CRISPR-Cas9 system, that it'll use the wild type allele that's already there and make the fix based on the DNA that's provided in parallel, basically, which is pretty cool.
So that does, I agree, it's cool, but it's also kind of interesting because, one of the things it says is like, okay, we're trying to do this and you get this outcome, but in essence, you don't, or do you understand the outcome? Is this something you say, all right, we've got what's going on, or is this, you get the nature of my question?
I do. And there's a lot of conclusions we draw without knowing fully what's going on. And I think that's just the nature of how complex science is when we do it. We're looking for an end goal. And when we achieve that end goal, we'll be able to describe certain phenomena that have contributed to the mechanisms that have produced that end goal. But there are a lot of other things that are going on that we may not be able to articulate exactly what it is. And so,
that's fair. And I guess the nature of my question is this kind of gets into the last question is, you know, should we do this? And so, you know, it's one thing to say, all right, we're looking at how this works out in this system. And, you know, but when you're starting to now say, all right, we're going to go in and tinker with the human genome, which is big deal in my book. And, you know, our ministry is very reticent to say that's a good idea. I mean, I think we would say it's probably a bad idea. If we don't understand things well, you know, you can, you know, if I'm building a shed and I don't know why this works, but I get a good shed, that's one thing. But, you know, in here, you've got a lot of who knows what's going to go on type things. And so should we actually do this?
Well, so that's a really great question. And I think that's, you know, maybe some people will pause and think that's a good question. And others will be like, let's see what we can do and just do it. But there's a distinction that needs to be made here. One is, should we be doing genome editing in adults or in adult cells, or should we be doing genome editing at the germline level? And the germline is basically the sperm and the egg and the zygote, something that's going to produce an individual that all of the copies of all of the cells and all of their bodies have whatever manipulation you've done to their genome, right?
Okay.
And so germline applications are basically, nobody's saying this is okay. Nobody's saying that we can make these kind of changes to the human embryo and then actually literally allow that embryo to come to full term in a live birth.
Okay.
Right? So the applications thus far have just been what can we learn about human development and what might be possible. One of the articles that came out that drew our attention to this, actually both of them were from an MIT review publication. But the first one that was released was called First Human Embryos Edited in U.S. And I think that's something that really needs to be sort of emphasized, that this is the first time U.S. researchers have published anything about manipulating the human embryo with the CRISPR-Cas9 system. But the second one that came out, I think, is far less responsible and far less professional, because that headline reads, Gene Editing Study in Human Embryos Points Toward Clinical Trials. And, you know, honestly, there are so many things that need to be cleared up scientifically at a technical level before we even start to get to the ethical questions as to whether or not germline manipulation and gene editing or embryo genome editing should ever be allowed to go to live birth. And that's really what they're talking about when they talk about points toward clinical trials. So I just think that's rhetoric to catch people's attention and really irresponsible.
No, I think that's fair. And I know we talked a little bit beforehand, but you know, it seems to me there's, in a large part, it's surprising to me that they can even do this. I mean, I've
absolutely
thought there was a moratorium or a, you know, getting research to do embryonic research and, you know, but, you know, setting the troubling aspects of embryonic research aside, what sort of regulations are there? I mean, are we set up to do this ethically at this point?
Well, so, you know, even the basic research that these researchers reported was highly regulated at an institutional level because Oregon State Health Center receives a lot of federal funding. And so they have internal review boards and they have all kinds of regulations for generating embryos and doing embryonic research and different panels that review that, even if it's not federally funded, mm-hmm. if it's independently funded, research institutions still have review panels mm-hmm. because they want to make sure things are being done ethically. You know, in the UK, I don't think it's as regulated here in the US, but in the UK, they basically track every embryo that they create mm-hmm. From the day they create it until the day that it's destroyed or used in an experiment. And if they lose track of an embryo, they're basically in jeopardy of losing their right to do that type of research. So there are regulations that could make it more stringent, more difficult for individuals to do this type of research in the U.S. But basically, if you're privately funded, you don't have to follow any regulations. There aren't any, like, penal regulations or legal mandates that basically say you can't do this kind of research. They're just saying we're not going to fund it at the federal level, and we're not going to allow you to go to clinical trials because at the clinical trial level, we're going to say you can't do that.
Okay. Well, so that's a little disturbing in the sense, I think I remember reading one of the articles referenced, and you've had a number of blog posts that you can find on our website about this, but there was, you know, it's like Sean Parker had a fairly substantial multimillion-dollar investment into doing this sort of research. So that would not be subject to a lot of the federal regulations.
Absolutely not. That's right. Yeah.
So that I think that's just something
they would still
need to be aware of. But,
well, yeah. And I want you to, I want to be clear to our listeners that means that, that doesn't mean that people that are receiving private funding are doing this without any nod to what ought to be done ethically, right? There are recommendations mm-hmm. from the scientific community about what should and shouldn't be pursued. They can sort of pay attention to that or not, but you know, people that do this type of research, they don't want to be ostracized by the public or shut down because of public outrage, and so they mm-hmm. often will hire ethicists to work mm-hmm. alongside them and help sort of raise the ethical questions and help them make sure that they know what path they're going down.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, I guess kind of the bottom line of all that is this just highlights the importance of Christians being involved in the scientific process and involved in the scientific community, that if we don't, we're basically ceding this discussion
right.
to a group of people who are not guided by ethical concerns as laid out in Scripture. And so
that's right.
If we don't do that, we're minimizing our voice, and I think that's a bad idea.
Well, we're not just minimizing our voice, but we're really sacrificing our culture
and
the future of our culture
right.
to become less moral, or at mm-hmm. least less biblically moral.
So, right. Yeah. Any closing thoughts?
Yeah, nothing comes springing to mind right away.
well, we've covered a lot, so that's
we have. So we can leave it there.
All right, very good. So I just find this, you know, from a technological standpoint, it's remarkable as we see what goes on inside the cell. You know, just the elegance of this system is pretty remarkable. Even as a, you know, not being aware of all the biology of what's going on in the molecular systems, it sounds like it's a pretty elegant system. And the fact that we can harness that technology and actually utilize it to do something is pretty remarkable.
I agree with that assessment wholeheartedly. You know, one other thing did come to mind, and I don't want people to think that by talking about this that we're advocating for embryonic research. I certainly know that many people would take a strong stance against any type of embryonic research. This research is going on. What is a little bit of a solace, perhaps, is that at least in this particular study, none of the embryos went past the 8-cell stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really only 3 days after fertilization is where they truncated it. And regulations in the UK necessitate that it's prior to 14 days post-fertilization. So there are some regulations that control what researchers can and can't do. But, you know, that for some people, that's not even satisfying. And I think that's okay that that's not satisfying to some mm-hmm. people. And we need to be in discussion about, should we even be doing this type of research?
Yeah, I think it's
because,
a good point.
Because we can try and intervene at the post-birth or the adult phase level, right? If
mm-hmm.
we get good enough at targeting a specific tissue that contains specific cells that the mutation needs to be fixed there,
right.
then maybe we can answer the problems to diseases like this but at the adult level and not having to go to this place.
Well, and that was part of the discussion in this even. And, you know, so you say, all right, you might be able to solve this at the germline level. You know, very often this is happening in the context of in vitro fertilization or something like that, which has, you're already dealing with all the creation of the embryos there. So you've passed that ethical discussion.
That's right.
Left that behind. But even at that, you know, at some level, you can, you know, if you're going to go down this path, you can choose which of the embryos you're going to put in. And so you can choose and select the ones that are this. But again, you get into some fuzzy, very difficult, very challenging stuff very quickly here.
And sorry, but those comments just raised one more point. You know, you're right. We already sort of walked across a line many, many years ago when we said we're going to allow in vitro fertilization. And there's a parallel line that some people may not recognize right now. And that's if we allow this type of manipulation to fix a diseased gene, that's stepping over the line, right? We're allowing this technology to be used to intervene at the genome level and to affect subsequent generations, right? And as soon as we've stepped over that line, the line becomes fuzzy. And then we start getting to questions like, well, what if I want my child to be tall? Because short people are at a disadvantage, right?
Or fast, or intellectual, or whatever, or thin,
or blue-eyed, right? So once you cross a line and say we're going to allow editing of the human genome at a germline level or an embryonic level, then what's to stop you from sort of expanding out just a little bit further? This is a line that we need to consider. What happens when we step across it in any situation?
I think that's a good point. And especially, you know, even beyond that, just the problems that exist now technologically of, you know, the mosaicism and the, you know, are you doing what you think you're doing?
That's right.
You know, the ethical concerns of allowing something like that to propagate into a human being. And there's a whole can of worms there that I think there's just big concerns there. But I appreciate you stepping in today, helping us understand this. I think, again, it's important for Christians to have a voice in here, recognizing the elegance of what God's done, but realizing we're dealing with stuff where we're playing with tools that could be much bigger than our ability to use them well. And so we don't want to do damage here. And so let's just be careful. Thanks for joining us. Join us the next time as we come in and discuss the latest scientific evidence and how they point to the creator of the Bible.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.